Welcome to the chat. But yeah, so today I'm joined by Cody Sheehy, who is the director of the documentary Make People Better and the co-host of the Make People Better podcast, which, as I've said, I've been listening to for 2 days. And it is a really fascinating podcast. The documentary I haven't seen just yet, but I'm sure we're going to dive into everything that it's all about. And it takes a look at the genomic revolution in the age of biology, where genes and DNA are being designed or altered within ways as to fight disease or design a baby's, in a sense, which is the first one I listened to fight a certain disease. But can this be used for good or bad? To fight against the inevitable death sentence we all have, which is another one we're going to go over, which is immortality. It's truly fascinating, and I can't wait to dive into it. And Cody is in a on a boat, and I'm in a shed, so I think it's going to be an interesting part. So, well, welcome.
I'm really excited to be here, and thank you for having me.
No worries. My first sort of question to you as well is, I looked into sort of some of your previous work as well, which was one documentary you did on water, and the other was insects. But is your line of work, has it also sort of been the sort of balance between human and nature?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. But my interest has always been ecology and nature and natural resources and just how people intersect with those forces. And so that's been the through line. So genetic engineering was a little bit outside of what I had done before. But once I really started to understand genetics, it is nature. I mean, it's the ultimate expression of nature. And so once I sort of wrapped my mind around that, that helped me, I think, kind of frame my own approach to it. So,
yeah. And so where did the sort of line of jumping from, you know, I think it was an insect documentary to the water documentary, and then to where did you stumble upon going into genetics and DNA and this kind of work?
Yeah, it's interesting because I was sitting in my office and I just got a call out of the blue one day. I picked up the phone. On the other end was a genetic engineer named Samira Kiani, and she's the co-producer of the film too. So we were partners throughout the entire production. And she starts talking to me, and at first I didn't know what to make of it. I thought she was saying, like, you know, I'm a genetic engineer. I'm working on a lot of stuff related to humans. I just feel like the public really has no idea what's going on in the field, and that there's this massive gap that's developing between where the science is and where people are and what we understand. And she's like, that gap's going to be an issue. And I think there should be some kind of documentary made or something. And like, I want to help do that. And so she'd gotten my name from somebody. So we started this series of conversations, and I thought I knew a lot about science and genetic engineering, but she was right. Like, it started to blow me away exactly how far along a lot of this tech was, and how just incredible some of these ideas are. The themes in this are deep. I mean, immortality, for example, that's something that humans have been kind of questing after for ages, right? And like, now, like, we have a new technological approach to it. It's not impossible that there could be very well, you know, real advances here. So started learning about all these things. I realized that she's right. There's a new revolution that's about to unfold. Nobody's talking about it. This is going to be a big deal. It's going to affect everything we do, like how we produce food, how we produce chemicals. We'll have the ability to completely reshape any species in nature that we want to. So it'll change how we do conservation, how we adapt to climate change. And it's going to change how we have babies. So instead of, you know, just having babies naturally, the movie Gattaca, I think, nails it really well. We're going to start really selecting the best traits that we could possibly have, choose to put those in our children and have children in a very different way. How is this going to be done in, say, Western societies where capitalism and markets drive things, versus how is all this technology going to be applied in places like China or other countries? These were all like fascinating questions that nobody was talking about. And so that's where we dove in. Of course, once we started filming, the story of JK, the scientist who secretly created the first two designer babies in China, Lulu and Nana, twin girls. And that was in 2018. That story hadn't happened yet. So we decided in the course of our producing to go to China. And we had heard from a lot of people like, you know, probably China's where this is going to happen. They've been known to push boundaries or kind of trying to claim technological advantage right now. If it's good, if the first baby's probably going to happen in China. So we were there looking, and sure enough, we met him. And once we met him and that story started to unfold, that really took over the documentary. So we just knew like we got to focus on this thing because it's like the moon landing. It's just a really succinct, powerful story. So I had to put the whole genomic revolution kind of on hold for a little bit, but I think that's where the podcast comes in. The podcast is going to try to tackle more of it. So
yeah. I mean, the information you're covering as well, it would be a very, very long documentary. I mean, I think a podcast is right. I mean, it's taken me 2 days and still trying to wrap my head around the first one. With JK, I mean, trying to, you know, I've digested quite a lot of information in the last 2 days, but trying to grasp what he did was it that there was a male with HIV and a female, and then they had babies from that, and then they was resistant to HIV and AIDS?
Yeah, that's correct. So what he did was he removed an embryo from the mother. The mother did not have HIV. They implanted that with sperm from the father, who was HIV positive. They edited that embryo to knock out a gene called CCR5. And that gene is known to change if it's knocked out, meaning it doesn't function anymore. They disabled it. That's known to cause our immune system to act a little bit differently, and our T cells and how HIV infects those changes. And so then suddenly that person is immune to HIV. On the other hand, there are other consequences to that. And that's what's crazy about genetics is you pull one thread and it kind of connects to a lot of other things. So these babies are more susceptible to dengue fever and other things. So our immune system evolved for a reason the way that it did. So they are resistant to HIV, but they're more susceptible to get these other diseases. It also affects your memory and intelligence too, perhaps. So there could be some connections there.
And is this more recent? Because, you know, the last I sort of saw of it is that they're healthy, but they're still quite young, aren't they?
Yeah, they would be around 4 years old now.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell. It's the time that tells you the secrets or what's going to come along, really, I suppose. But, you know, and then what happened to him? Because did he go to prison for 3 years?
Yeah, so that's what's the interesting part of the story, where it really becomes kind of a thriller, I suppose, is that there is an international kind of red line drawn around this type of experimentation on babies. So anything that's germline, which is a term used to describe editing embryos or sperm or something that's going to affect the entire human being and every generation after that. So it's a dangerous thing to do because it'll affect their children and their children and their children as well. So they drawn a kind of an ethical red line around that. No US scientists wanted to touch it, but there's a growing kind of desire in the field to break through this barrier and kind of get people opened up to the idea of doing germline editing and editing babies. That's when JK kind of enters the picture. He sees that this technology is all right there. It's all ready to go. He can step in and kind of claim this very historic prize, you know, of doing the first humans. But he knows he's going to face bitter backlash because of the ethical boundaries. At that point, he gets support from the communist government, and they tell him, look, we want you to have a big breakthrough for China, but we don't want too much controversy around this. So you can go ahead and do it. We're going to support you as long as there's not too much controversy. If you do this in a way where it blows up and it does not go well, we will not protect you.
We're gonna help out, but you know, he's my friend. If shit hits the fan, we're not gonna be there.
We're not there. Yeah, it's kind of like a special forces guy behind any alliance type thing. Don't get caught because we'll just But so at that point, he knew the Western media was where the PR battle was going to go down, and so he hires a a really great PR guy. And they start, and also he starts rounding up as many high level US scientists as he possibly can. And I mean, we're talking the top people, pioneers of the field, really were in his court, telling him to do it, urging him to do it. And he thought he had what he needed to do this and then release it in a very boring scientific way, get it published in Nature, you know, slowly kind of leak this out to the public. And hopefully he could keep a lid on the controversy and have a very legitimate scientific experiment that would help usher in all this stuff. Instead, what happened is our team was over there. We met him. We had brought a journalist with us, this guy, Antonio Regalado from MIT Tech Review. And he's really like, I mean, he's just kind of a, almost like a film noir detective, you know, he's just on the beat, just, he leaves no stone unturned. You know? And once he met JK, he's like, I know that's the guy. He's like, I know, I don't have the facts, I don't have the evidence yet, but he knew. He went back to the US and on his own, he went and did a bunch of research and found documents on the internet that proved that JK had done the experiment. The babies were already were born or aborted. He didn't know which, but he knew that the experiment had been done. And so he got enough to publish, and he published in such a way that it just really became a bombshell and a huge international story. And that story then just took off, and the controversy kind of was born at that point. So you asked, did JK end up going to jail? What happened first was the Chinese government said, you need to come back to China. Don't get up on stage and talk to the world like, you know, it's over. It's too big now.
Yeah.
But he knew that this was his last chance. So he got on stage anyways, answered questions to the Western press. And then after that, he was disappeared. So no one knew where he went. No one could find him. His family didn't know where he was, really. I mean, no one knew much. New York Times was able to locate him. And it turns out he was like under house arrest. And they took photos of him and that kind of thing. So we, and then at that point, he was disappeared further. And then eventually was tried and then went to prison. So.
Yeah, what a journey he's had.
Yeah. And now he's out.
So, and now he's out. And isn't he continuing? I did have a little Google on him. He's continuing doing some work with MS now, I think.
Yeah. I mean, he is ambitious as always. He's got a lot of work to do to kind of repair his image. But yeah, he wants to get back into it and do more gene editing. And someday, I'm sure he's still hoping to get the Nobel Prize. You know,
Do you think it's not really sort of the mad scientist, but do you think, you know, like as you said, that the babies are more susceptible to certain other diseases, or you take that part of the gene out, then, you know, does that mean that curing it from that point isn't quite the right way? Or, you know, it's a bit of a dangerous method, you know, when we do have some forms of curing it when it is. I mean, Do you think that's how he is, in a way that he's just trying to, you know, get the Nobel Prize rather than, you know, cure HIV? It's like, I can manipulate genes and that's the scientist I want to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In terms of protecting an unborn child from HIV, there are many good ways, safe ways to do that. Like sperm washing and things like that are probably the much more accepted method. So there was no medical reason to do this. This was purely experimentation. To claim the prize of having the first and he chose CCR5 because it was a well-studied gene, and the odds of it causing a massive health effect for the babies if something went wrong in the experiment, it was small. So he did it. He knew that if the babies were born very, very ill, that would be the biggest risk. So he chose a gene that was safe to edit.
Yeah.
And that's why it ended up being HIV. Once he picked CCR5, then he backfilled the story with HIV a little bit, kind of creating a need for that. But
and what through your work on looking into like changing genetics, what else have you come across in these stories and other sort of scientists? Like, how far can we go? Like, you know, I did see a person with Down syndrome in Congress, and I think he was, you know, protesting for Down syndrome, because you can change that before you can find that out now, I've heard. And he said, you know, this is the point where you would eradicate me, and I'm quite capable. I've lived quite a fulfilled life. You know, in some essence, people would look at it like it's a burden on the parents if their child is like that, or they've got to live a life, you know, that's harder, or, you know, but then abortion isn't illegal in many cases as well. So what's the right way to do this? And what do you know, what else they're doing?
Well, we are at the very tip of the iceberg so far in the conversation, but I think you hit on a really important one, which is right now, the way that, that this is being introduced into society is through rare genetic diseases. And then you have things like Down syndrome and deafness, which are, which could be created from a genetic situation. And those communities, I think, are less, they don't want their disease to be treated as a disease necessarily.
Of course.
So there's all kinds of interesting things that are starting to happen now that those things could be cured before they're born. So that's just in solving disease, but what about enhancements? And so that's really where this goes, I think, is, we developed the technology for medical reasons to prevent rare genetic diseases. But once you perfect this, there is no reason why you cannot use it to make people more intelligent, to allow people to choose designer traits like eye color, hair color, height, musical ability, like all these things that people may want on a commercial market that extend beyond just being healthy. So they're all the same.
Or to make soldiers.
Or to make... Yeah, exactly. Super resistant soldiers. Just the other day, there's an article published in China where they were able to take genes from some kind of creature and insert them into this human embryo and make it thousands of times more resistant to radiation. And of course, they didn't grow these into people, but if they had, that would be a soldier, perhaps, that could survive like a nuclear war. So,
and then going into... I mean, that is not a soldier you want to go up against.
Yeah. And some of the very easy ones, there's like 40 easy fixes right off the bat. George Church, a famous genomic pioneer, has a list of the really easy ones. And they include like increased strength, stronger bones, resistance to radiation. These are all, many very superhuman things are the easy ones at the beginning.
And have any of these been tested, or are they sort of tested on mice or worms or...
Yeah. I mean, we know them through like natural variations in humans. Like sometimes there are accidental reasons why these genes would be enhanced or knocked out. And so that's where the list comes from. CCR5, JK in the babies is the first test.
Yeah.
And CCR5 was on George Church's list. And that's where JK got the idea to do it.
The other thing I stumbled across yesterday, because I was like, well, what about cloning and that side of things? And I'm not sure. There is a lady that was in court and she apparently cloned a person years ago. And I couldn't get the right information on it. It was kind of warped. But do you know of any cloning? I mean, there's been a cloned sheep. There's been, I think, a cloned dog. Yeah. Or that's just Vanilla Sky.
I think there has been some cloned animals, yeah.
But I mean, has your research stemmed into anything like, you know, cloning organs, you know, how that's going to go? Because leading into sort of immortality, that's where I think it's going.
Yeah, for sure. Cloning humans, I don't know the latest on that. I know Antonio did a big investigative search for cloned humans, and that didn't turn anything up. That was a few years ago. So I don't know if there's cloned people walking around right now. Of course, on a cellular level, we clone human cells all the time for research purposes in vast quantities. So it's a early and tried and true technology for sure. For organs, the latest on that is creating pigs that have human genetics mixed in with them. So they're called chimeras. So they're part human, part pig. And the pig will grow a human organ inside of it, or a pig organ that's covered in human receptor cells so that our immune system won't reject it. And so that's kind of the latest on where the organs are going to come from. So
God.
Yeah. So you wouldn't need to grow a whole human and harvest the organ. You just grow pigs harvest the organs and then
and do you think that's quite an early stage to where we could grow it in, say, sort of, you know, a petri dish or some sort of fake embryo? Do you think the pig? Yeah. Because to me, it's very strange growing it in a pig.
Yeah, I think it's a long ways before we could grow an organ from scratch and not have an animal because there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, when you grow an organ, it forms in a matrix, needs to be exercised, it needs to do its functions, you know, and it's a really complex environment inside, you know, a mammal body. And so that pig that uses that liver or kidney or whatever, I mean, it develops it so that it's actually a very healthy organ for you. To grow it in a petri dish, you're going to get a lump of tissue that's like liver tissue, but it's not necessarily the kind of thing that's ready to keep you alive. So
it's a little bit, I mean, it's going a bit far-fetched with the way I'm thinking, but it's a little bit like Neo in the Matrix. It doesn't work without the mind. He can be in that little bath, horrendous place, not know he's there. But if the mind isn't active, then, you know, the body doesn't work. And I suppose things like a liver and everything else, it probably has to work and, you know, be in its kind of essence in order to grow in the right way, I guess.
Yeah. Right. Like a human, a body just is like a huge system.
Yeah. Poor pigs, though. We're not eating them. We're growing inside.
Well, you maybe could eat them too. I don't know.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. I mean, the first episode just really got me, really, because it's changing, as you said, like, how is it going to be taken upon in the Western world? You know, when it can be very materialistic and money orientated, and, you know, we could look at it just as a surface level, like, you know, are we fully capable of changing someone's appearance in the sense of, or is it just eye color, hair color, or can you change, you know, the sort of shape or structure of someone?
Well, if they're an adult, there's less you can do, but you can do a lot. I mean, we are a product of our genetics and our environment. So the genetics is a huge part of that. So even as an adult, you could probably change your eye color, for example. I mean, I think as it's a spectrum and a pathway. So the more we learn about genetics, the more we'll be able to do. And right now we can do very targeted things, but in the future with greater mastery, we would be able to do a lot.
And I find sometimes that's a little bit, you know, after just listening to Bioterror, it's like you kind of have to create a lot of these things. I think it was you yourself that said it, you know, you kind of create if you're looking at a virus, you kind of have to, if it's been created or nature's created it, or it's been created as a weapon, you kind of have to create, you know, the virus to create the antivirus. So in a sense, when we're going into this world of changing genes for disease and everything else, of course, other things, maybe negative in some light, may come from it. But, you know, it's fascinating to see where this is going to play out. I feel like we're in this absolute crazy time at the minute. Like you were saying about AI as well. It's just like AI now is just insane how much it's doing all the time. And the way I see tech is that we're just trying to catch up with it all the time. True. How far do you think there's tech that's more advanced in the gene world? I mean, it's completely spectacle, but that we don't know about?
Yeah, I was thinking about that the other day, and it's like with the AI thing that's happened in the last few months, suddenly the public is just totally aware of, you know, ChatGPT-4 and
yeah, that's like my new Google best mate.
Yeah, exactly.
Not
yeah,
I mean, female lad.
And it's mind blowing, and we're all terrified for our jobs, and we're terrified for these different things, and we're also really excited about all the capabilities. But it's sort of like the tech is done; it's here. They're rolling it out. Yes, you're welcome to debate it or whatever, but it's too late. It's already done. With genetic engineering, we're a little bit earlier on. So if the public is to become aware of what's going to happen with this now, there's a chance to actually steer it towards
in the right direction,
more the positive benefits. That's what I really hope people start to really think about this and get into it now, because there's still a chance to control it. So for the good. Yeah. And there's a lot of good that can happen too.
What would be your worries of it being bad?
Well, I think there is a massive spectrum of problems that can develop. Yeah. So it's hard to know where to start. But I mean, just to try to, at a high level, genetics is extremely complicated and it's extremely powerful. And it's one of those things that humans probably will never fully understand. Yet we're going to dive into this and harness that power. And so, like the scientists who are developing, say, nuclear science, they envisioned a world where we would unlock the secrets of the atom. We would create unlimited power. It would transform human civilization for the better. We'd be able to explore the stars and all these utopic ideas that they had of the future, very techno-optimistic in how that would go. And the reality is, once we understood that technology, it was kind of really moved into, you know, making nuclear weapons. The Cold War developed. There's now tens of thousands of nuclear warheads that are pointed at each other right now, and a single president or something could hit a button and annihilate all life on Earth. And we've been living under this threat forever since that breakthrough. And that was an unintended consequence that those scientists had no idea would develop. They just didn't envision that. And it's so hard to envision what could come. So with genetics, with the power to control the very nature of life itself, what are we unleashing with that? Like, yes, the low-hanging fruit is we can be more healthy, and that is a good thing. The downside is there's no way to control genetic engineering. It's cheap. It's easy. DNA is everywhere. There's no dog in an airport that can sniff it out and suddenly alert the authorities or something. We just saw with COVID-19, the ability for the world to deal with pandemics now in this globalized world is very, very low. We're basically putting the power to create a COVID-19 pandemic in the hands of every high schooler. And there's, you know, and as our mental health crises continue, and I just worry that giving 8 billion people the power to do something like that, it just takes one, you know? So I think the FBI, I think a lot of experts around this topic just really say it's a matter of time. And it's not just going to happen once. It's probably going to happen all the time. It's just going to be something we're going to have to deal with. Humans are going to have to adjust to just synthetic viruses being released constantly by bad actors. That's part of our future, likely.
What do you mean by bad actors? Bad people? Or?
Yeah, I mean, just like a school shooter, instead of going to school with your rifle, you might, you know, just order some DNA on the internet, synthesize it with a device you could buy for $1,500, and then release that and stuff. So,
that's terrifying.
It's terrifying. Yeah. So, I mean, we're going to be, the good news is at the same time, we'll be able to develop vaccines very quickly, probably. And so we'll just be constantly going in to get the latest shot to protect us against the latest problem. It's going to be an arms race there.
My only worry with that is, you know, it's again the rollout of the one we had. There's been a lot kicking off on that side of people with, you know, problems adverse to it. It's come out too quick, you know. And then it's again like with what virus has been put out, how well do we know what the counterpart is? You know, either way it's bad.
Either way.
Just, you know, just need to support people's mental health and stop being nuts in certain avenues.
Well, that makes sense too. If we're all happier, there'll be less synthetic viruses released.
For sure. I mean,
I don't know. I mean, on the vaccine debate, like people worry about vaccines. I totally get that. But at the same time, I mean, if people are sick all the time, society will adjust to that.
Yeah.
Everybody wears their seatbelts on the freeway now. You know?
Exactly. Unless you've got a 1960s car like my dad, and it's not, that's what cracks me up. If the car is before the law was instated in England,
right,
it doesn't need a seatbelt. But it's like, it clearly needs one, Dad. It's definitely illegal. But it's legal in those terms. But the other thing you said as well about, you know, the scientists who focused in on the atom, and it got turned into, you know, the nuclear war sort of thing we have over our heads. You know, that kind of reminds me a bit of like Nikola Tesla and, you know, JP Morgan, and the way we went down into an oil industry when Nikola Tesla had completely different technology, which was more, you know, electrical and based upon scalar technology and frequencies. You know, I feel now, from my research and where I sort of go and find my information, that we are going into a lot more of an awakened state of, you know, making health better, making life better. My only worry is that we might be at another point now in time where it's like, again, like you're saying, we need to get the word out there and go in the right directions again. Otherwise, we're going to have another 100 years of madness.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, we're at that crossroads. You haven't listened to the next episode yet, so I don't want to spoil it, but
is it the next one? It's not out yet, though, is it?
It's not out. Yeah. It's called Valley of Shadow, and it's about the culture of biotech. And I think your question might key in with that a little bit, but it's essentially Silicon Valley and the development of the computer industry, smartphones and social media and all that, really is the basis and the primer for the biotech culture. It's the same funding mechanisms, the same kind of VCs, the same, you know, go fast, break it, and then disrupt it kind of ideas. So that overlap, I think, is really where a lot of these problems are kind of coming from. And so it's a cultural issue, I think.
Yeah.
And so I think that's really where you look for the solution. Yeah.
So my other question, I've got many, but would you live forever if you could?
I know, I spent so much time thinking about that. Okay. It's hard to say. I mean, immortality. I've asked everyone that same question too, by the way. And the older you get, the less likely you are to want immortality. So I found that to be interesting. For myself, I mean, the fear of death, it's been there my whole life. We all live with that. We do so much to avoid death.
Should do some mushrooms.
Yeah.
They help with that.
we can adjust. Yeah, totally. I think at this point in my life, I'm old enough that I would not want something like that. I've got a son now, and it's interesting to like see your own genetics passing on through that. And you get a deeper sense of immortality there, that's in balance with nature. So,
yeah. Yeah, I think I was trying to find, I've always been fascinated by how long people have lived. And a lot of the time it's in India, you find the oldest people. So then I look at lifestyle, you know, yoga, meditation, what's their diet, you know, what's it like to live there? They get a lot of sun. You know, in England, I think, you know, you're constantly looking for it. It's never there. It's just a permanent gray cloud. But I found one person, died in 2000. There's been a few, but they're a bit debatable. Like one was an Indian who lived to 256, but they were trying to work out. It's not as written in stone as you would like scientifically to find out where he is. But the oldest recently was 138, which I found nuts.
That's crazy.
It's like, what is he eating?
Yeah, for sure.
And I think, go on. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say there's a length of our life, you know, 138, and then there's our healthy life, like how our health span. So that's the key number for me.
And I think this is where immortality and genes and DNA and everything, you know, through your episodes, it completely, you know, combines itself really, because, you know, stem cell treatment, if organs can be grown, if you can, you know, if you can go in and change genes while a person is alive at that point and remove, you know, like in films, you see like a med bed, you know, these really quick ways of just changing it. Then, to cut it short, if you look at Tom Cruise, he doesn't look 60. You know, he's flying a helicopter while filming himself in his 60s. Like, you know, it's clear that the wealth around age and everything else does change how long you live. And my point to that is 138 in 50 years, that person at 138, it may not even be close to 138 the way that their body is.
Yeah. I think it's going to be really easy for us to reach 120 years of good, healthy, vibrant, like for Tom Cruise, 60 years old, kind of vitality. And after that, it's like less clear how difficult it'll be to extend it. But yeah, that's going to be easy. And it's not even going to be a health bed that you get into. It's just going to be a single shot that you take. It's going to mess with three different genes that'll rebalance your immune system, get your immune system to functioning like it was when it was 20. And then that immune system is going to go out there and take care of cancers and take care of all these aging related issues. And that's really the easiest first kind of step towards all of this.
And so, I think people understanding food a lot more as well, you know, processed food, you know, the chocolate aisle, the crisp aisle. I think these things, you know, but I've always said like to people, you know, if you look at a car and if you drive it every single day, you know, that car and you put fuel for it, it's the fuel in the car working that kills it. You know, so you've got to put the very best into it. And I look at food, if it's not right, it is killing the body. But I think that's something people are really waking up to now. My other sort of look at mortality is sort of our change or the way we might go into being, what's the word, like cyborgs, you know, where the body is no longer the body, it's more of a synthetic or a robotic body. What are your thoughts on being a robot?
Well, there's a whole movement out there called the transhumanist movement. They believe that we are steadily marching towards further and further integration with machines and enhancements through genetic engineering that'll eventually achieve immortality in some form, probably a cyborg kind of form. So there's certain things we can fix and there's certain things we can't fix, and those will replace with machinery. And that's their view. And the ones who recognize that they can't achieve that in their own lifetime are freezing themselves so that they can be woken up in the future when those technologies are available.
Cryogenically freezing, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I think we went Simon to one Cowell on that. Yeah. Did you go to one?
Yeah, we went to one and filmed in there, and they were freezing ahead while we were there. It was pretty wild.
Did you see it?
It's inside like a
cylinder, a
stainless kind of canister. Yeah.
Yeah. So that why not just freeze the body? It's cheaper. That's why.
It's cheaper. Yeah. If you just do the head, it's like it's a discount because it only takes less space.
Yeah.
So they can give you a discount.
That's crazy.
And you can also do your pet too. So one guy froze his dog with him as well. So his whole body and his dog.
It's literally Vanilla Sky. You're going to see. I bet that was Tom Cruise's head in there and it was Betty the dog.
I think so. Yeah.
No, I find that mad. I've looked into it, but I didn't know you could just freeze your head for cheaper. What sort of price range is that?
I don't know the exact numbers, but the idea, it's somewhere around a common life insurance policy. So if you had a life insurance policy, you cash that out and then put it into this, and it would transfer over. So fairly affordable is the idea.
I mean, just imagine though, like you wake up and they go, look, you know, we couldn't really find the right body. And you know, you're on something completely different than you thought it was going to be. You know, it could turn into a bit of a nightmare. That's anything.
Yeah. Have you seen the show Atlas Carbon?
No. Say it again. Atlas.
I think it's called Atlas Carbon, I believe.
I saw a little bit of it. Yeah.
What you just said reminds me of a scene there where they're waking somebody up and that person was like low income or something, didn't have a lot of money. And so they...
Yeah.
Woke this person up into a body of like a 70-year-old woman that was like almost ready to die again. But that's all that his plan could afford. So,
yeah, that's not good. I mean, going back to what you said as well, that you're now a father, and being at this age in your life, it's made you think, no, I wouldn't go into something like that. You know, obviously that's just a personal option and a personal approach. But, you know, my worry is if this is if this becomes something that someone could take from a very young age, say 18, 20, and then, you know, obviously there's ways out, you know, but they're not easy ones, suicide or anything like that. But, you know, if someone chooses to live to 250, you know, and then it's something they don't want to do, it could become quite horrendous at the same time. Or maybe there isn't a way out the way you've done it. There's always walking in front of a bus, but you don't want to, let's face it.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird to think about it, but it's like, if with modern medical technology that we have today, if you get something that's easily curable and you decide to not take that medical intervention, your friends and family would find you to be selfish and very odd to not solve this medical issue you have and die prematurely for no reason at all. And that's going to be the situation in the future too. If you opt to die at 90 and there is cheap and easily available technology to keep you alive at 250, wouldn't your wife and kids find that to be a very... So there's this societal pressure that's going to build around extension.
What do you mean you don't want to live anymore?
Exactly. You don't love us anymore.
Who's going to make me a cup of tea? Yeah, I get. Yeah, I mean, exactly. when there's such a choice of such a vast choice as well, like that kind of time frame, you know, you get to 100 and you're still skipping and running around, and then you can live to still 150. I think that is definitely going to be something that disrupts many people around, because we don't really know how long the mind can cope. And also you go through, a lot happens in 100 years. I mean, if I look at my dad, he's 75, and you know, World War II was when he was really born. So, you know, the internet catching up, you know, I think my age, I'm 33, and, you know, many people that grew up in my age group, technology is like our right hand. You know, it's, if you're not growing with it, some people don't follow it, but I always have done, because you have to stay with this within the times. But with my dad, it was like, you know, it was this time and now this time. You know, and I find that's very complex. And if I was to live 200 years, I think that would happen as well.
Right. I do too. Yeah.
Mm.
And one thing to think about is, like, you find it natural for your dad to live to be 75, but in the old days, we'd only live to be 40. So we're already in this strange future in some ways. We've already doubled our lifespan once. But yeah, keeping up with technology, it's like, thought about that too, and like, I'm 44 now and I'm starting to not want to get on the next social media platform or whatever. I'm just like, yeah, I've got enough, you know, I'm full, I'm saturated with new tech.
me too
I'm okay. But on the other hand, it's like, if I had 200 years to go, would that change my mindset? It's kind of like the end of a car of a road trip. You start to anticipate the end a little bit and you're like, yeah, you know, I'm gonna push through. But if I had a long ways to go and I'm like, okay, I got 8 careers ahead of me still, I need to stay on top of tech. Maybe I'd stay in that mindset a lot longer. I don't know.
Yeah. Know your lane in that sort of way, innit? And otherwise you just, you know, it's too much anyway. I think as well, like with immortality, I mean, death is pretty much the most unexplained thing. I think to be alive, you know, if most people in this realm don't understand what death is like in that way. You know, there's many out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences, but, you know, I think our understanding of it is quite low. And I think to prolong it, or, you know, I think that's more scary to me than gene manipulating, to be honest. You know, because I find it's just to prolong so much as well. There's people that don't have... the greatest lives, in the sense, to prolong it here as well. It's tricky, but I found that one the most interesting pod as well, because it's just like, oh my God, living forever is terrifying. And then to have someone's head in it, it's crazy. Yeah. How long do they get frozen for?
No one knows. That's what's crazy about it. Yeah.
So that you can just, they can stay, and do they... But the thing is, in my understanding, is that the tech isn't quite there to wake them up and do it yet. It's obviously a holding state until we get to that path.
Yeah. So at the temperature that they're at, there's really no cellular damage anymore. So they can probably stay there for a really long time. But the way that they were frozen is probably will someday be considered really old school and damaging and bad tech. And so the ones who are frozen later will probably be woken up first. And then as the waking up and repair technology improves over time, they'll look further and further back into the archives to the really tough cases from the very beginning. And so the ones being frozen now, maybe if this scheme works, theoretically would be perhaps the longest to be frozen. So,
but then it's also like our understanding of consciousness and how that connects to DNA. I mean, DNA has been built through ancestors and generations. And I suppose in my way of thinking, consciousness in a certain way is either external or internal, and it either connects to that DNA. So if that person's woken up, but the person with just the head, does he still have spine to heart to gut? Because they're all part of the brain.
Just head.
Yeah. Because I know
the idea is that they're gonna go through and map all the neurons in the brain and then recreate those in a metaverse situation. So the other alternative is that they would use a person's DNA and regrow a clone body and then put them on to that. But in that case, they're definitely not getting any memories that are stored in the spine and reflex parts of your So,
but even the heart has, I think it's got 40,000 neurons in it.
Yeah, those are.
What was you going to say?
Those are gone. Those are gone. Yeah, they didn't make it.
Because some people have had like a heart transplant and then been able to play the piano. And the person who they had heart transplant could play the piano.
That's wild. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's so incredible. Yeah.
I mean, well, you know what heartache is. You know what I mean? It's, you know, I think there is a lot going on in the heart that to separate it. That guy, that's, you know, he might have some regrets, the guy in the jar, maybe. But.
Well, I think you're getting at, to me, it's like a human life, a brain, a mind, a consciousness, a body. Mm. It's all one system. It's all one thing.
Of course.
And to just pull the brain out, I think is a very interesting and terrifying concept.
Mm. Well, they say if you go cheap, you go twice. So in this case, that might work.
Yeah, for sure.
So the other thing that I fell into as well was the biohacking. And I mean, biohacking can also be for good as well. I think my understanding of it before, from what I've looked into, is people that are, you know, sort of breath work or scalar technology or frequency work or, you know, gong baths or, you know, anything like that, sort of biohacking, you know, for good. But the biohacking, if you could explain the episode I last went to and what your work was around that, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a huge movement. It's one of the fastest growing areas of the biotech industry ever. It's just regular people who study the techniques of doing biological engineering. And since it's so cheap to order the different chemicals and tools you need, they can just set up labs in their garages or their homes and start to modify organisms or create hacks for themselves. And so this started, and right away, little companies started to kind of pop up out of this to sell pretty dubious cures that were being created in these garage labs. And spectacles started to unfold right away. Kind of a culture developed around, you know, doing a big product release, like an Apple iPhone or something, but this like small scale, and then you go on stage and inject yourself with whatever you made to prove that it works or something.
Mm.
And so this, that's kind of how they, you know, entered into the public consciousness.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of, it's not the same, but Dallas Cowboy, you know, what Matthew McConaughey played, I think it's Ron Woody, something like that. I can't remember the name of the person.
Yeah.
Is it jogging your memory as well? But you know,
it's like Dallas Players Club, I think is the name.
Yeah, it's where he's a cowboy that gets HIV, and then, you know, he's pushed out from his family because they think he's gay. And, you know, and then he goes, I mean, obviously in America, you know, the healthcare is different, you know, drugs aren't free. So he goes down the route of supplying in a sense to, and they said he only had sort of 3 weeks to live and he lived to 7 years. And I think in the end, they allowed him to have the drug, but they didn't actually approve it. The FDA didn't approve it in that sense. And do you think the people that you're coming across through biohacking, it's more, you know, not in regards to medicines too expensive, it's more, can we see what we can do with this?
Well, I do. I mean, there's a huge community of people who have a disease, and these biohackers are the one chance they've got. You know, the FDA isn't approving the drug, or it's too expensive for them. And so, you know, they might contact the biohacker and try to get an off-market kind of solution somehow. Yeah. So that's what's driving it, is there's a need there.
I think also, though, that I don't know how to make penicillin, or, you know, in these terms, that kind of information is something I haven't really gone into and thought of, because, you know, I live in a safe society for now. But I think it is something that could be good in education if people are more, you know, the average person, you know, anyone knows more about biohacking in the sense of what could I use to help this? You know, I find information so tricky to get through.
I would think, in my opinion, though, in the case of gene therapy, it's an extremely powerful situation. I mean, this isn't like taking a vitamin. You would want this to go through human trials, through the FDA or some governmental regulatory system, and make sure that it's safe, because it's a very, you know, it's a lot can go wrong with these. So,
and what sort of diseases are the main things these biohackers? I know there was, it was two people that you was talking to in the episode I was listening to, and it kind of went quite south, didn't it? From my
Well, so just to kind of tell that story a little bit, Joe Zahner is really one of the most famous biohackers. And what happened there was, there's something called myostatin, which is a gene that if you knock that out in pigs and cattle, when that myostatin gene doesn't function, they develop double muscle. So they become just like massively ripped. At that point, Joe is a bodybuilder and injected this at a conference and became one of the first people to actually inject something like that. And so all these bodybuilders started contacting him, saying like, hey, can we buy some myostatin knockout from you to help with our bodybuilding? And so the company that got set up was called Odin, and they started to sell that to people. The FDA shut that down immediately, but that inspired, that on stage injecting stunt inspired other companies that popped up. So they were going after herpes right away. And so the guy, you know, got on stage, Aaron Trawick, and dropped his pants and injected himself in the crotch, you know, and just created, just becoming total spectacles. And then eventually they started working with HIV and found Tristan Roberts, who is HIV positive, and he was willing to inject himself with a series of experimental HIV drugs. In the case of Aaron Trawick's company, Ascendance Biomedical, they really, like Joe Zahner, for example, is a PhD. He used to work for NASA. I mean, a lot of knowledge there. Aaron Trawick and that company does not have the same chops. And it really was a snake oil situation, probably. Just selling cures, just trying to get investment. And so eventually Joe kind of got on social media, called them out, like saying, hey, people, don't buy this stuff. Like, this is dangerous. And once another biohacker is calling them out, it turned into a big social media scandal. Aaron sues Joe for $250 million, I think. And then 2 weeks later, he's dead. He's floating in a sensory deprivation tank, drowned. So then an investigation got open for like foul play. Turned out that was nothing. It was just an accidental drug over, and he drowned, unfortunately. But, you know, you can see kind of all of this played out like in a public way. And then so Joe's company, the Odin, over the years has really pivoted to just selling kits to like science teachers and things like that, and really grown into like a very legitimate company. And Joe, over the years, really done a lot to distance himself from that initial kind of
hiccup.
Sort of hiccup. Yeah. Mm. And try to, you know, still on the edge for sure. Mm. And that's part of the brand. But
is it still quite a huge market then, sort of black market that's going on? Is there still a lot of it happening?
It is happening. And I knew you were going to ask me about this. So I actually called Antonio before we talked. Mm-hmm. Said, you know, what is the latest with the biohackers? Because that's something I haven't followed as close as he does.
Yeah.
He was telling me that he sent me an article that's from MIT Tech Review. But basically, there's a situation in Honduras where there's like a kind of a crypto state where you can set up companies in the city. And so the Ascendance Biomedical folks that are now down in Honduras doing something where you basically, I don't understand it fully, but you buy a coin and then that coin gives you access to the company, and it's in a totally unregulated space. And it's just kind of the latest intersection of all these different technologies coming together. But it does. One last thing I would say is there's 40 countries on Earth that have no medical regulations, and those are really free for all spaces. And so kind of, if you want to do like a tax haven overseas, like we all know about that, I think this medical stuff is kind of going that same direction. You can go to a country, do experimentation on people in an unregulated way, and then bring the products back to, say, the United States later. But
yeah, there's a terrifying film called Old where people go. Have you seen it? Where it's where people go. Yeah. And they go to an island, and it basically, the island makes them grow. So the kids that are five within 5 hours are 30. So everyone there grows within 25 hours really quickly. And the whole film, you don't really know what's going on. But what they're doing by that is they get a group of holiday family and whatever, and they live an entire life in 24 hours. So what the company is doing is seeing what diseases they have within that time frame, and they can find really quick medical cures, but at the expense of people growing extremely old. But it's the craziest film I've ever seen in my life. But I found it interesting that you said, you know, there's 40 unregulated places, did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you went to Dominican Republic.
Yeah. So with Joe, we went down there and worked with a... At that point, they were potentially setting up an unregulated clinic to do muscular dystrophy work. I don't think anything has gone forward with that, but that was the situation. Yeah,
I mean, it's bad, but it's good. I mean, it's unregulated, but at least they're trying to find something. You know what? How incapable are these people? You know, have they come from a zero background in biology and medical background, or are they partly capable and that's why they want to do it, because they can bring the product to the market and actually cure things like MS?
I think it's too early now, in my opinion, but someday all this stuff will be very easily accessible information, and it probably would make more sense to find cheap solutions for places that can't afford expensive. I mean, right now, gene therapy might be like $1 million. It's a lot of money. And someday we need to bring those costs down. I don't know if it's through unregulated medical experimentation, but the problem they're trying to solve is very real. And I think you're right to point that out.
The other one I've listened to, how many have you got coming?
there's seven total. Yeah.
Okay, cool. I'm nearly there. They're great. Yeah. The last one, I can't remember what it's called, but it's more about nature, mosquitoes, and it's with the mammoth wild. Is it out the
it's
wild?
It's called Code of the Wild.
Code of the Wild. That's the one. Another fascinating one. I mean, nature just fascinates me so much, because it's beyond us. I think we're always trying to learn from it. You know, I've always said to people, we haven't yet made something this big that grows into something that's 50 foot yet. So we're not even close. But the fascinating part I saw about it as well is the wiping out of mosquitoes and how that would be done. Could you go into detail on how that would be put into effect and what this episode is about as well?
Yeah. Well, again, it's just the tip of the iceberg, but one of the very first tools we have to really modify entire species out of nature are something called gene drives. And what gene drives do is you insert a little bit of genetic technology into, say, a mosquito. You release, say, I don't know, a few thousand or 100,000 or a million mosquitoes out into that population. They go out and breed. And every time they breed, they insert that genetic code into the offspring, and it goes and does a CRISPR cut on the new offspring and makes it grow to be male. And then that newly edited male goes and breeds, and then its offspring has that CRISPR code in it. That CRISPR then activates, goes, changes it, and makes it male. And so very quickly across the entire mosquito population, they all become male. And then the mosquito population crashes and wipes out and dies. And we've, by in a lab somewhere, we were able to create something and release it that changed an entire species in nature. Something's been around 100 million years. Mm. And so they're doing these experiments right now. Because why would you want to do that? Well, you know, mosquitoes carry malaria and a lot of really nasty diseases. And we've been trying to eradicate mosquitoes through all kinds of ways, pesticides and other things. Anyways, and so this is just like a really effective method for doing that. But it does speak a little bit to the hubris of humans to take the fate of an entire species in its hands like that and make a decision to completely eliminate it. And what else is going to end up on the list? There's already, that list is already really long. They want to do ticks. They want to change rat, invasive rat species. The agriculture companies want to go after all the pests that go after all of our agricultural crops. It's going to be a really long list. And you can just see humans, once humans have a tool like that, it's going to be hard for us to just put it on the shelf and not use it.
Yeah. Do we know, I mean, I'm not too clued up on the world of mosquitoes. Do we know what mosquitoes do for the ecosystem and why we need them? Or are they just a nuisance?
Well, they're not a nuisance. I mean, every species on Earth, I believe, evolved within the natural ecosystem to fill a niche, and it's there for a reason. Almost always, it turns out humans don't understand the full interconnections of something as complicated as nature. So it's very likely that we would make a mistake in thinking that you can just pull out a part out of the engine and then suddenly everything's going to be fine. But that being said, somebody pointed that out to the mosquito people, and they're like, right now, rapidly trying to assess their ecological role so that we understand, quote unquote, what they do in the ecosystem. And we have a better idea of what that would be.
Surely that would have been the first thing.
Yeah. I mean, that's how best my
maybe we should see if we need them.
Yeah. Rather than, oh, let's eliminate them. We've decided to eliminate them. Let's quickly study to see what the consequences might be before we do it. I agree with you. I just, on this particular one, I sort of have a point of view. And it's my background is in ecology. And I think you mentioned that at the beginning of the,
insects,
of the podcast. Hanging around those kinds of scientists, they really have a lot of respect and humility in the face of nature because they've been around for a long time, many, many conservation efforts and interventions in nature and different things that that particular field of science really understands how fraught this kind of intervention can be. Whereas the genetic scientists, they're from a different part of the scientific world. It's one that's really, an indoor science, you know, they're in the lab all the time. They're hanging out in places like Boston and San Francisco, and they don't spend a lot of time in nature, and they've never tested these ideas. And so they have an oversized sense of like what they can accomplish and an undersized humility for what the repercussions might be if they are successful. And so on this particular one, I really hope we listen to the wisdom that we've gained over in the ecological sciences. But
yeah, for sure. Because, you know, there's always save the bees and, you know, everything like that. I mean, everything has a ripple effect in nature. You know, a lot of farmers in certain parts of the world where there's lions and, you know, tigers or, well, lions really, they'll put out poisoned food. So then, and the adults know that. So the adult mother and father know it, but the children, the cubs usually don't, and they go for the food. And then, so through us eating cows or through that nature, you know, even just the poison deterrent takes out that part. And that's just a tiny, tiny sort of little ecosystem there. So yeah, when you're talking about a mass scale of taking that out, I think it's, yeah, it's something that's got to be looked at in a lot of depth. And the after effects would be so quick, probably, or slow that we don't even know they're creeping up.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just hard to imagine what they could be. If we're just successful in eliminating mosquitoes, there'll be unintended consequences from that. Mm. But if it turns out that these genetic changes spread to other species or mutate in some way or other issues, you know, it's hard to imagine.
Mm. And I noticed the picture is a mammoth.
Right.
Yeah. Are you a fan of the mammoth coming back?
No, I'm glad you caught that, because that's a subtle thing. So one of the inventors of gene drives is George Church. The other one, George Church and his lab are actively bringing the mammoth back to life right now.
Yeah.
And they're going to release him in Siberia.
And yeah, so, my housemate is going to love this, because he's like, you know, they're bringing back the mammoth.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. So yeah, and that's one of the things that we could do in these massive ecosystem level interventions with genetics, is bring back the de-extinct species. So.
And is that because there's a specific part of DNA found with a mammoth, or it isn't from fossils, is it?
Is the question why we're choosing the mammoth?
Yeah. I mean, we've got enough extinct things happening at the minute. I think bring back the ones that are already around in this time. But at the same time, you know, why not bring back the mammoth? But my question is, what is needed in order, you know, can we bring back a pterodactyl? Can we bring back, you know, a megalodon? You know, part of that, you know, DNA or gene, or what is it that needs to be found, or what has been found with the mammoth that's allowed us to do this now?
Got it. Yeah. Well, I think the mammoth DNA is well preserved, and so we have complete good DNA to do a mammoth. And at the same time, the mammoth is prehistoric enough in our storytelling, in our mythology, that it feels close to Jurassic Park. So I think you have a nice combination of PR and also something that's kind of possible. And I'm guessing that that's how the mammoth sort of project got started, because it's a great story. It's got legs. Mm-hmm. We could easily bring back, you know, the latest salamander that just went extinct last year easily too. But the mammoth feels very ambitious and Jurassic Park like. So
do you think that's where sort of, you know, not to say in a bad way, but where ego gets in the way of science and what should be brought back?
Well, these are all humans making these decisions. Yeah. And definitely ego is part of the equation. Also, being able to raise VC funding for it is a factor here. So,
yeah.
George Church told me, though, that he's always surprised that journalists always ask him about the mammoth. He's just like, that was just a tiny little idea I had, and I put one grad student on it, and that thing has just taken off in terms of the public's interest. I mean, what he's mainly focused on is immortality, the pig organs I was telling you about, things like huge, huge level things. The mammoth is, for him, a curiosity and a side project. But it did recently get a lot of funding, so it's growing. The project is off and running.
And do you know much about how that's actually been going to be brought to life? How it's going to be grown? How anything like that?
Well, they've run into a lot of problems, because in order to grow a mammoth, you need a mammoth mother for it to grow inside of. And so
not gonna fit in a pig.
Well, you'd put it inside of an elephant is the idea.
Yeah, of course.
But elephants are endangered, and there was some backlash to that immediately. And so they decided to not put it in live elephants for the moment. And they're working on like a huge artificial womb that will grow a mammoth. Mm. Also, this mammoth has a lot of elephant DNA mixed in with it to modernize it. So it's got, I don't want to misspeak here, but things like perhaps a modern immune system that can cope with the things that exist today and stuff like that. So there, it's an Africanized elephant that's being modified to be like a mammoth, essentially.
Yeah, because like we could have different oxygen levels and, you know, through things, mm-hmm. you know, the size of things back then was different, maybe because they think maybe because of the oxygen levels back then. So, yeah, I can imagine probably going to be like, Jesus, what's all this car pollution going on? But Siberia, there might not be too much. No, it's fascinating. Yeah. It's been amazing. And what you're doing is literally the sort of areas that I'm always trying to scope out, and to have it in a small package of you know, hours and hours I can get for it in a couple of days is great. What is sort of next for you? What are you sort of doing, you know, in the world of genes? Are you going to continue sort of this immortality in genes and that work, or
I'm actually not sure what will happen with the genetic engineering thing. If there's interest in this and people want more, then we'll keep going. I've started another documentary right now that's called Manta, and it's about a diver down here in Mexico who dove in the sea over 14,000 times, and he became great friends with a huge giant manta named Willie. And Willie would give him hour-long rides through canyons underwater and stuff. And he has all this amazing footage of him climbing on the back,
yeah,
and going on these journeys around this island. And this guy has a troubled past, though. He's kind of an ex-Navy SEAL, an ex-Hells Angel. Mm. He's in Mexico because he's kind of running from the law a little bit. And so one day, some fishermen come into this island and massacre all the mantas. And at this point, this guy, Terry, goes on a mission. And he filmed the whole thing, and he wants to find those fishermen and track them down. And he'll just show that footage to anyone who would watch it. And eventually he got the president of Mexico to watch it, and those fishermen were arrested, and then the island was protected. So it's the story of how that this manta sanctuary got started. Mm. Yeah.
I love that. That's so good. So you're really yeah. going back into another form of nature, which is amazing. Amazing. Is that why you're on a boat?
Yeah. Yeah. I live on a boat during the winter. So
amazing. Amazing. Well, there is one final question that I ask everyone as well. And that is, what is reality to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was excited for this one. So, I don't know if you're familiar with Don Hoffman or not, but
it rings a bell.
Yeah, he has a great theory of what reality is for a human being, which when I heard it, I think I subscribed to it. Mm. That basically, I mean, you know, reality is the objective truth of the universe. It's going to be true no matter what animal is looking at it, but how each version of a human or a bat or anything perceives reality, I think is interesting. And I think in the case of humans, for sure, what makes sense to me is like the reality, the world that we see is kind of like a video game on the screen of a TV. And it's an interface that makes it really easy for us to interact with what the universe truly is. But what the universe truly is probably nothing like a two-dimensional projection on a video screen. It's probably zeros and ones and chips and bits and wires and hard drives that are actually creating that. But we're just interpreting it, parts of it, and mm-hmm. modeling something that works for us. And I think that is the reality that I live in. So
I love it. Hey, you're going very close to simulation theory there. but
only in our mind. Yeah. I don't think we live in a simulation, but just I think we simulate something for ourselves. Yeah.
100%. No, it's been great. And I will put all the links below for everyone to see as well on your podcast. And when will the documentary be out in the UK?
I'm not sure. It's been difficult. So they're releasing it country by country, and it's a different deal for each country. So I can't give you the answer. Guys,
yeah. So, well, send me a secret link and I'll tell everyone about it.
I will for sure.